Now I call upon Professor Pearson.
Thanks so much, Tony. I was not separating myself from the panel in any disrespectful way, but simply so that I could see the slides. Lots of good common sense from Norm, as usual. And part of what I want to do is to pick up on one of the words that Norm used, and that's the communication side of the issues that Tony sketched out for us. And starting first with a story from Sudbury, this illustrates very well what can happen when good policy hits the ground. And by the way, you will notice that I'm not being a scientist, and my y-axis is labeled with horizontal language. One of the characteristics that scientists do not appreciate when they talk to a public audience is that you immediately put a barrier between yourself and your audience if you label your y-axis vertically. It's only scientists who read from bottom to top. No members of the public ever do that. It's a very simple thing to do, and it is indeed a useful recommendation to all of you. And if you're doing posters, remember that you don't have to save the sort of space that journal publishers like to save by putting the words vertically. It's not necessary at all. So the more important thing to see here is there are two things to see. First of all, the regulations which brought down the sulfur dioxide emissions in Sudbury, and each of those bars you will have gathered by now represents the emissions in a year creeping up to toward the present, although it's not right up to date. And you'll see that the emissions went down underneath the red line, which is the regulation limit set by the Ministry of the Environment. I was in Sudbury at the time that Jim Bradley came up in the early 70s and discussed those limits, the first step of those limits, with the mining companies, particularly Inco. And of course there were protestations that it couldn't be achieved, that the technology was not available. But in fact, I know from talking to people since then that at the time Inco was in fact already researching the technology. And furthermore, one of the other lessons is that the big stack, which you can just see appearing on the about the 1970s here, just on the right-hand side of the bars, which was part of the technological solution to the emissions issue, that was paid for within 10 years by the recovery of the 1,000 tons of nickel and the 1,000 tons of copper, as well as platinum and gold and precious metals, which were spewing out of the small stacks, one of which you can see on the side here, one of three that operated in the 1930s. So the technology, in fact, was paid for out of savings that came about because of achieving the emission reductions. The other point is illustrated also by the Montreal Protocol, which is Tony has already mentioned, and I print screened this slide, so the y-axis is still in science speak or science orientation. And that you can see, too, how the successive stages of the Montreal Protocol resulted in the same diminution, the same reduction in chlorofluorocarbons. The point is indeed one that Norm made. The most important point is that you can achieve reductions, you can achieve changes in behavior, changes in emission reductions in both of these two cases, if you can point your finger at the player, the actor in the game who has to make the change. It's very, very easy to make those sorts of changes, very easy to have the public on your side when what you're doing is you're reducing skin cancer cases. There is not one person walking down Sherbrooke who would argue against any strategy, any policy, any imposition of regulations that reduced skin cancer cases. There might be some who would be surprised that we're still climbing towards the maximum number of skin cancer cases toward the middle of the century as a result of ozone depletion. People have already begun to regard this issue as over with, and we're rudely reminded, as Nigel mentioned to me, as Norm was speaking, that perhaps it was when Tony was speaking, that that this last winter in the Arctic was one of the largest ozone depletion winters that we've experienced. This issue may be less over than the conventional wisdom. Nevertheless, my point here is that there is no need when the benefit is reducing skin cancer cases to engage the public. But climate change is enormously different. And part of what I want to go to is to some of the research which has looked at the constituencies, the breakdowns that you need to understand if you're to engage the public. To engage the public in a way that brings them into the policy-making process, that engages the public in persuading them to change behaviors, to play their part, as the jargon would go, in the reduction of greenhouse gases. And it really is important to go to the literature and to get away from the generalizations about the public. There is not such a group as the public. There are many publics. And the six that Lazarevitz, Tony Lazarevitz in Yale distinguished are those that you can see here. And the group, the 60-odd percent, are the 20, the 22, and the 19 of the alarmed, the cautious, and the concerns. They make up a group of people who are already convinced enough of the science that they're waiting for leadership. Communicating more science to those people will not shift them any significant place at all. What they need is leadership, and they need leadership that involves communication with them and understands the way that they see the world. I want to quickly just give you a little more detail in those categories of the world views, of the characteristics of those categories, because if you don't understand them, you cannot begin to communicate with them. And I want to emphasize this too. This is from a fairly recent paper in risk analysis, a 2004 paper, which emphasizes that what's important about a group of the public, whether it's climate change or whether it's genetically modified organisms or whether it's nanotechnology, if one's communicating about the issues and the social impact, the societal impact of that science, then you need to be very, very aware of the worldviews of your audience. The notion that what we need to do in order to get the public on side is to have them understand the science, to go out to public audiences and to talk at them, to lecture at them about the science, is simply wrong. It is simply wrong. There is no shorter, better word for it than wrong. That kind of one-way transmission communication, that sort of outreach, and that's another recommendation I would make to all of you, take outreach out of your programs. What you want is you want engagement. That's what you want. You want dialogue. The idea of outreach, where scientists go out and communicate their knowledge to an audience, is outdated and is not valuable. These are with one slight change. Lazarevitz changed his terminology to take the unconcerned group and to turn them into disengaged, which I think is a better description. And the percentages have changed a little bit. This was another survey with the same questions, but a couple of years later. And the numbers are a little bit different. The word that's important on the left that we've just introduced here is motivation. The belief in global warming, the concern in global warming, is part of the everyday language of describing the characteristics of the public. Motivation is important. And furthermore, motivation to become engaged in action, to change behavior. When Lazarevitz went out, the Yale group went out and looked at the support that there was for policies, they tried out several, and there are three here, and it's one of his slides, and I apologize for not being able to read the y-axis well. But it runs from strongly supportive to moderately supportive to moderately opposed to strongly opposed. Those are the steps on the y-axis there. What it's important to understand is that the dismissive, the unconcerned, the right hand end of these plots arise not so much from the misunderstanding of the science, but from the worldviews of those people. If you look at the characteristics of them, and we'll whistle through quickly here, Tony. I can see you looking at me and looking at your watch. If you look at the characteristics, and I'll leave you to read them here very quickly. There are differences in the perception of the threat of climate change. But part of what you also see beginning to come in, especially when you read the descriptors in detail, is the conservativeness, the opposition to taxes, the opposition to government, the idea that the best government is less government. It's not so much the science that's the issue here. It's the willingness of people to be subjected to the limitations of the imposed by government policy. In other words, to be, they would say, pushed around in the way that INCO was pushed around in order to reduce the SO2 emissions. There is somebody and who made a very interesting and important speech in the last week. It was not part of our election campaign. It happened in Georgetown University. It was by this man, who was speaking to U.S. Citizens about the need for energy policy, renewable energy, the introduction of efficient energy efficiency, all the sorts of solutions which should be talked about in the election campaign that's going on in our country. If this speech had been made in Winnipeg or Vancouver or here in Montreal, there would be reason for congratulation. You might remember what happened to Stefan Dion's green shift in the last election. It wasn't that it was voted down. It was that it was belittled as an idea. And that, I have to tell you, makes me angry. And you might also recognize this face, who was in the audience at Georgetown. Does anybody know who that is? It's Stephen Chu, a Nobel Prize winner in physics, who was brought into the government policymaking circles by Obama at the same time as we were getting rid in this country of our science advisor to the federal government. And you might also know that John Holdren was brought into the U.S. government at the same time from Harvard. And what Obama was speaking about was the need for innovation, speaking about jobs, about not being dependent on finite energy resources, all the sort of framing that one needs in order to move those who are in the middle ground, to move them towards solutions to climate change. It's an energy issue. That's what it is. It's an energy issue. The way we're going to tackle climate change is through energy efficiency and alternative energy sources. And Obama gets it. And I'm not picking on Obama just because I like the Democrats. I'm looking around on this continent for a leader who understands how to communicate, who understands his audience, and can use imaginative language to catch that audience. And one has to go south of the border. When one goes south of the border, one also finds a lobby group which has been very effective, the coal lobby, lobbying against changing energy policy. But one also finds the Western Climate Initiative. How many of you know that Quebec is the co-chair of the Western Climate Initiative? Did any of you know that? Maybe one or two of you. And the Western Climate Initiative is looking at plans for cap and trade. Have a look at the website for the Western Climate Initiative, led by U.S. states. U.S. states, right? began with Oregon and Washington and California in 2007. Ontario are members, just like you are, also BC, also Manitoba. So there is action going on in provinces, sadly not at the federal level. At the federal level, we get this nonsense. Some of you might remember the National Roundtable and the Canadian Geographic unveiling of the Climate Prosperity Program last fall. And you might remember this chart from Canadian Geographic. Do you remember that? Anybody remember that? Norm remembers that. One of the most misleading pieces of communication, one of the most irresponsible pieces of communication that's come out from any government anywhere. Buried in that table, each of these horizontal lines represents an impact. Some benefits and some impacts. This up here illustrates a benefit. Greater access to northern oil, gas, and mineral resources in the Arctic, right? Prosperity. Yeah? Down below, on the scale of 2 to 5 degrees, buried, in fact, at the bottom, the last purple line, well, you can see I've ringed it, you know, conflict. In other words, wars over resources, over water, not over oil, but water and food. That's a game changer. Now, to put that on a chart like this, with the same kind of priority as better access to resources in the Arctic, is just plain irresponsible. It is just plain misleading. It makes people think that they're equivalent. They're not equivalent. War over resources, because of changing weather patterns, is a game changer. And to put this in the context of prosperity, the National Roundtable say that it's reframing. My response to them has been, that's not reframing, that's spin. That is spin, plain spin. And that's the best that we've been able to do in this country in the last 6 months. And part of what people need to remember is this is where we're heading. To be trying to engage Canadians by pretending that we can head towards prosperity because of climate change is nonsense. Outright nonsense. So not only do we need to figure out how to connect with people, how to understand the audience, we need to get away from this sort of irresponsible garbage that's come out from the round table. I talked to some grad students about posters. You need to go to the University of Buffalo Library site. You need to post your posters online. A couple of good sites to do that. And I'm taking advantage of having the mic to mention that to you as well, after all the work that you've done on these. Thank you.